Good morning. I'd like to welcome everybody to House Education Committee. It is 8 o'clock on Wednesday, April 8th. President Representative Keller, Representative Wilson, Representative Edgman, Representative Gardner, Representative Book, myself, Chair Seaton. I remind everybody about those cell phones. And today we have three items. HB 59, pre-elementary school programs and plans, SB 57, charter school, and HB 215, student counts and teacher salaries. Friday we will hold confirmation hearings for the Board of Education, the University of Alaska Regents, as well as bills previously heard, and Representative Munoz is with us as well.
Thank you.
Is there anything come before the committee before we begin? Seeing none, let's take up House Bill 59. We've heard this bill earlier. Representative Kawasaki, would you identify yourself on the record? And
you bet. Good morning, Chair Seaton, members of the Education Committee. For the record, Scott Kawasaki, member, District 9, representing Fairbanks. Do you want me to just introduce some of the amendments that were?
I just wanted to get you up here and make sure that we didn't have further questions. We also. I think we closed public testimony. Did we? I can't remember. Let's check on the bill. Is there anyone on open public? For House Bill 59. I'm going to close public testimony. Now, committee discussion. Representative Wilson.
I move amendment number one, and this amendment is /E.2.
Okay, we have before us an amendment number one, and that's to page 4, line 24, following A, we're going to insert progress. Representative Kawasaki, we've talked about this. Just officially, you are in agreement with this amendment?
Sure. Yes, Mr. Chairman. We discussed the possibility that with the commissioner's office that they might not be able to finish on a specific deadline. This gives a little bit of a progress report, gives them a little bit of an out to make sure that they get that they move forward, and so that the legislature is able to see that they're making progress toward what this committee would like to see in the end on pre-K programs.
Okay, thank you. And just for procedure, I objected to the amendment for discussion. Yes, Representative Book.
Which are we working on? I'm looking on page 4 of my copy and line 23. Are we looking at a CS for this or something?
Are you?
Let me see.
Workcraft E?
Yeah, we should have workcraft E.
Okay. I'm on it. Thank you very much.
Let's see if we have our. Representative Book, so you found towards the end of that line a progress report.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Are there is there further discussion on amendment number one? Seeing none, I'll remove my objection. Are there any other objections to amendment number one? Seeing none, amendment number one is adopted. Representative Wilson?
I move amendment number two, and that is /E.1.
Thank you, and I'll object for discussion. And amendment number two is to page 3, line 27, and it's deleting 3 and 4 years of age. Representative Kawasaki?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We spoke also with the department on this, and we felt that the idea and intent of a pre-K system would be that all students would be able to be involved, and better than defining a specific age group, if we just pulled it out of there, let the department decide. It's their intent to proceed with the 3 to 4 year olds because that's pre-K. But if we took that out, then you could also include other types of educational opportunities for young people, even younger than 3. I just wanted to cite that there is another amendment perhaps coming forward that also details with that, or dovetails with it. So I don't know if you want to try and amend those together.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Keller.
I would request that maybe if this could be withdrawn as an amendment and consider the other E-1 because it's a little broader and it just reduced the confusion. It's the next, the other E-1.
Representative Wilson, are you?
I will, that's the will of the committee. I will withdraw amendment number 2.
Well, one explanation on that is I talked to the
Representative Keller.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to explain to Representative Wilson that I had talked to Representative Kawasaki.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Thank you. So I'm removing my objection, and Representative Wilson is withdrawing amendment number 2 at this time. Representative Wilson. Or Representative Keller.
I'd move Amendment E-1, in your, what you have there, but it's by me instead of the one by, I'm sorry. Amendment number 3 in the committee here.
Miss, just a minute, let me check to make sure. Yeah, okay. We have Amendment number 3, which is a conceptual amendment. Offered by Representative Keller, and we'll not worry about the designation for clarity in the committee here. This is a conceptual amendment. It's not there. So I'll object for discussion. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the sponsor of the amendment, the word families is substituted, the word students would be taken out and be substituted by families with preschool children. Is that just a sort of an overarching term, or is there a specific purpose for putting that term in there?
the intent is very clearly to change the focus from students to families, and the reason is, of course, the parents are the ones with the jurisdiction over the child from birth to the school, and the commissioner was talking about this the other day, and he envisions resource centers for families, working with families. We've been hearing from parents as teachers, and I frankly, to give a little bit of background on it, I think that it is the right way to go. I think parents are uniquely designed to know the uniqueness and the individuality of every child more than anyone else. And so if we work with the parents in the education program, it just makes more sense to me. I've been reading on several studies and researchers on preschool, and by age 3, I'm glad that's part of this is the 3-year-old part, a child has heard, I think, 8 million more words in a family that is not, that is more prosperous than some of the others. And so the child is really at a disadvantage at age 3 because they've spoken less words, they've heard less words, and whatever. And to have the education system go in there and try to devise a program for all these preschool children is tough. But if the emphasis and the focus is on giving the parents resources to work with their children, then it gives me comfort to move forward. Otherwise, frankly, I don't have the comfort. That's where I'm coming from. But parents as teachers, we heard the testimony and what's going on in Hoonah, great community effort and successful, and that's oriented toward the families. And so that's what that's what I'm proposing.
Representative Edmund, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm trying to understand then the 3 and 4-year-olds that may not be in the traditional family structure. Foster children, guardians, or whatever the terms might be, how would they fit into this amendment?
Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The term family is not defined, and a child that's being foster care, the OCS is the surrogate parent until they put the child, give the child another place to operate. And so I'm just not presuming a traditional family definition here. I'm presuming whatever context the child is in, with parents, whether they're legal guardians or whatever. If we want to get explicit in that, we could, but I didn't think it was necessary.
Representative Gardner?
Thank you. Actually, Mr. Chair, my question was very similar to Representative Edgemond's, but I want to just point out that this is a significant shift in our way of thinking about preschool education, and I think it's appropriate because I have misgivings about having just everybody in preschool because not I don't think every child needs it. And I like the idea of working with families, and it also allows us to expand. And I mean, for a two-year-old who has special needs or something that needs it, allows that services too. So, thank you.
Representative Keller, I'm, and I'll get to the sponsor in just a moment, but I have a question. How would, I'm worried that we are now taking this bill that is talking about education, and now we're asking the department to write a plan for families. And I'm just trying to figure out if we go in that direction, are people comfortable with the department coming in and saying, here is the plan for your family? And I worry about that because I don't think that's your intent. And I'm not sure how that plan would be written. And so can you lead me down that path a little
bit? Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the question. Yeah, you note that in the I left the first words intact. Devise a statewide early education plan. That's there. Okay. And then also, remember, in the later in the bill, it very clearly says it's an optional plan. So it'd be an optional plan, what I envision is, I think, similar to what has been described here before, is a resource center where people that care about the children can go to families, particularly maybe underprivileged families, and offer resources to prepare them for education.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like this. I mean, what good does it do? I mean, it does good to the child if we're just dealing with the child. But when you deal with the family, there may be other children in the family that will benefit from this too. And so, I think that there's a real lack of knowledge in a generation or maybe two generations of people that have different thoughts on how to raise children, and some of them don't have a clue how to raise children because of the way they were raised. And so I think that including the family is very important.
And Representative Keller, excuse me, I'll get the noise out of it. My concern here is that we do maintain a focus and make sure, as we've all been talking about, parents and teachers and those things. Would it be a friendly amendment to consider to this to have students and families with preschool children? Because there are going to be those situations where a early childhood education plan will need to focus on the individual children, but that this would be very directly involving the families as well and give that direction, but we wouldn't have just families kind of at the exclusion of the student. Would that?
Mr. Chair, respectfully, I would oppose that suggestion, and the reason is we struggle when we take a child away out of the home, we struggle with providing the role and the of parenting. I don't know if you've seen recent audits and then on OCS, but OCS is the legally the way it's set up. They're the ones that hold the responsibility, and they become the family in a sense. So if you just said student, if you read this and it said you're doing it for the student, what you're presuming is, or the possibility, what you may be implying is that the education system is the one that takes the jurisdiction and the responsibility. And I'm not sure we want to go there. You know, I think that the way we have it set up right now, when a child is in trouble, they're under the jurisdiction of OCS. You know, so that when you get into the parenting role, you know, I don't know that we want to expand it in that way. So just put that right on the Department of Education.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. I support the amendment, but I do think that there is a semantics problem by saying students and families with school age children, because it it indicates that, you know, the students
may have children.
Preschool children. So if you intend to amend it, I think that should be clarified.
Thank you. And I guess my problem is that I think that if we do an early education plan for families only, not talking about the students, not talking about the children's education,
a suggestion?
I see us going in a circle. Yes, Representative Keller.
How about if we, after children, put who will become students? Would that satisfy you? I think it would be okay with me.
Representative Kawasaki, comments on your on the discussion?
Just a general comment, that when I originally saw the amendment, and I mentioned to the representative that I didn't see a problem with it, but now looking at it a little closer, I guess there is a significant change, where if a student, I mean, doesn't have access to a family, I don't know how that impacts the policy. Plus, I don't know if we really want the Department of Education to suddenly write policy to families. And I think that, I mean, I don't think you do. I definitely don't. But somewhere, I think that the students have to be commented in there. And I know it's just a conceptual amendment, but I personally would feel more comfortable if students and families were mentioned somehow. Interlinked, but, you know, not independently. I don't know how to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
The language that's still here says early childhood education. If we're talking about a child, I mean, who's not yet school age, who doesn't have a family and is not in a foster home, those children are generally in a residential treatment program where they have really intensive wraparound services. There's a reason they're not with their birth family or in a foster home. And they certainly have a plan, but they're focused on some really basic kind of issues first. So I don't think we're leaving anybody out by using the language that is here right now.
And Representative Gardner, my problem is not talking about children that have been taken out of the home. We've got a diversity of families across here, and whether we want the Department of Education writing family plans for people in rural Alaska, in urban Alaska, in all the different settings, we know how many different languages we have, and now we're going to say the Department of Education is going to write a plan for the family. And, you know, I think that we're wanting to make sure that we have a voluntary system. My fear is that what we're getting here in our intention is actually getting into good parents and bad parents and how they're going to be, and all of a sudden it's that's my fear. And I think we're in agreement on that. I think we want to have parents highly involved in the education, but I can see this being interpreted as the Department of Education now going to be writing family plans, and that worries me. Representatives Munoz and then Keller.
Well, I disagree. I think that the language is pretty clear. It says devise a statewide early childhood education plan for families with preschool children, and that is very inclusive. It allows the families, the parents as teachers program. It allows information for working families, single parents that need child care resources. You know, it's much more inclusive, I think. And I really don't think it diminishes the intent.
Sure.
I think it actually strengthens it.
Okay, thank you. And
On that point?
On that point, Reverend.
Well, I guess my concern, and not to dispute the amendment, but my concern is, are we going from a term students that's defined in statute, that's, you know, that's been around for a long time, to an open-ended term family that's not defined? And you know, talk about giving the department more authority to do what they do. You know, are we taking a defined term and substituting it with a term that's not defined in the regulation of the department?
Thank you, Representative Keller.
Well, two things. I want to back up first. The law, with and without the amendments, says nothing about a family plan and doesn't imply a plan. Respectfully, I mean that's a. I understand your question, but I don't think the language justifies that. And then with regards to Representative Edgman's question, I don't think that you'll find a legal definition of student of preschool children. This is a beginning of a plan in the department's working on it. And, you know, by putting in these terms, it'll just shift the focus, from maybe a education system based to reaching out to the families, and if you're more comfortable with putting in a definition of family, I think that's a slippery slope, because we could spend the rest of the session talking about that. Well, so I figured just leaving the general term would be safer.
And just to speed our conversation along, since you know, we were talking about maybe an amendment to this. Would the term an education plan for preschool students and their families, would that get us to an inclusive way in which we can talk, or would that not be friendly?
To me, that would not be friendly, because okay. It's a plan for families, and it's for the children who will become students. But the focus can be either or, the way you described it, and mine is narrower. So that's why, you know, it frankly is. You know, it's narrower in the sense that it applies only to the families. I'd like to stick with that, you know. So.
Okay. We've had a request from Representative Wilson to have the department address this. I'd like to call Mr. Jeans forward for a moment to see how this... Mr. Jeans, we're looking at conceptual amendment number 3, and the discussion has been on what the study would be if this was a education plan for families with preschool children, and trying to figure out if the department would interpret that differently than a educational plan as it is right now for students. And if you want to take a moment to think about that, we've been talking about it here for a while and trying to figure out how the department would address that. So we'll let you hold for a minute. Representative Edgman, did you have something further? Was there any other discussion from?
Well, maybe.
Okay, Representative Edgman.
Once Eddie gets a little more familiar with the amendment, I guess I'd like to ask him if there is a definition in statute for the term student, and if there is a definition for families. That would help me better understand, the difference between Representative Kawasaki's amendment that we set aside and Representative Keller's amendment that's on the table. Through the chair,
Representative Edgman.
Mr. Jeans, is there a definition in statute for the term students that the department relies upon, and also is there a definition for the term families that the department uses?
And through the chair, Eddie Jeans, Director of School Finance for the Alaska Department of Education, I would have to look that up for you. I can't answer that question right away. There's clearly a definition of school-age children in statute that we use for funding purposes. And that's what is utilized to calculate what state aid is available to school districts. In terms of families, I'd have to look that up.
And Mr. Jeans, of course, this section we're dealing with is on early childhood education. So we're talking about preschool students. And I guess the question is students applicable for preschool? Is that the applicable term that we should be using or the designation?
Mr. Chairman, as I've read this legislation, it's basically directing the Department of Education to develop a preschool funding model that's a voluntary model. If you want to include the language and family, an education plan for families with preschool children, I guess I still interpret that the same. We're to develop a preschool program, and there would be a family component in that either way. So I don't see a problem with the proposed language.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Edmund.
I just want to make sure that the grandparents out in Manicota or Togiak that are raising a 3 or 4-year-old aren't excluded by the department because they're not considered a family.
Through the chair, Representative Edmund, I can assure you they will not be excluded because I know that there's somewhere in our statutes where we refer to the custodian of the children. So it may be a person through foster care, could be the grandparent, could be the biological parents. Yes. So we'll make sure that it's all inclusive. Absolutely.
That's a good question.
Okay. Representative Boop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I'm looking at this amendment. I'm not making any suggestions here whatsoever. However, if you look at what is suggested between the written language and the amendment, if we're really just talking about a plan for preschool children, and we have these definitions within statute or within other protocol that the department works off of, it would seem to me that that's what we're asking them to do, is build a plan for preschool children. So we're discussing semantics, whether students or families are more appropriate, but actually what we're talking about are these kids. And if they build the plan, and we have language in there that talks about that, then it gives the department fairly broad language to use to develop that plan. I mean, it's a consideration.
Is there further discussion on the amendment? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to ask Eddie one more question. If I understood what you said, you would include the families either way. No matter what this says, they would be included in part of the whatever you decide.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't know how you would develop a pre-K program without including the families. In recent years, even with our statewide correspondence, there's been a huge focus on individualized learning plans that Representative Keller mentions quite often. So I know that that's a focus of the department in developing the pre-K program. And it varies from community to community what that program will look like. You've heard the commissioner speak on this issue. We're not looking at adding another grade level to the public school system. Bring all 4-year-olds in. We're looking at developing a program that allows lots of flexibility to meet individual student needs, individual community needs, which includes the parents.
Thank you. Is there any further question on the amendment? So we have, yes, Representative Edmund, did you have?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm just sitting here trying to catch up to what Eddie was just saying, maybe I need to get with Eddie outside the committee to just get a better definition of what the parameters of the term family really are, just for my own comfort level. I'm certainly not taking issue with his definition or the sponsor's language, but I'm just thinking about the village setting. I'm thinking about some of the family structures out there that certainly aren't traditional, that may even be outside of the grandparents' and the young children realm. So I'll just leave it at that.
And Representative Keller.
Just to comment to that, I think your concerns are really valid. And I was thinking, making amendments on the fly sometimes gets dangerous, but would you be comfortable with families or custodian of the children? I mean, if that's the term that he says is elsewhere in law, I don't have any problem doing that at all. That's my intent. My intent is not to limit, the number of children that be involved here.
Mr. James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I prefer not to amend it to include that language, because I believe that our definition of the parents' families is in regulation, and it'd be much easier for us to make reference to that definition through our own regulatory process in addressing this issue.
And I've been slightly uncomfortable with this, because I think that people are going to interpret this as the department is writing an education plan for families, with preschools. So anybody that has a preschool kid, there's going to be a plan developed by the agency for them. And as long as what we're doing is getting clarified on the record that what you're going to be focusing on is students and involving families in that, I'm comfortable. But I want to make sure that it's on the record that it's not the intention of this committee that the Department of Early Childhood Education is going to write a family plan that, if you're not following that family plan, then somehow you're a bad parent and this and that and the other thing, because that's not the intent of where we're going with this language. And I just wanted to make sure that the department is cognizant of what we're meaning and what you've described as a early childhood plan would be for these students involving their family.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That is my understanding, that we're to develop early childhood programs that would include parent involvement for the children, not individual family plans. That was never my understanding.
Thank you. With that, do we have any other discussion on amendment number 3? Seeing none, I'll remove my objection. Are there any other objections to amendment number 3? Seeing none, amendment number 3 is adopted. Representative Keller.
I'd like to move conceptual amendment number 4.
And I'll object for discussion. Conceptual amendment number 4 is to page 3, line 31, and that's delete or expansion of. Just deleting the words for on line 31, or expansion of. So the sentence would read, provides for the most effective and efficient coordination with pre-elementary programs operating in the state. Discussion?
Would you like?
Sure.
Representative Kelly. My only thought is that we're leaving it open here to programs that exist that are not part of the state system, and the department may not want to expand, they might want to reduce. It's going to be their choice, and I don't, it doesn't say expanding the good ones, it just says expansion of. So I think just taking it out, I think it leaves them the freedom to expand and encourage any programs they see as valid and without the word.
And Mr. Jeans, would you interpret it the same way, that if those words just don't appear in there, that you're not constrained from, if there's a good program, adding to that or recommending in this plan to expand, let's say, parents as teachers to some other communities or as part of the grant? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, deleting the or expansion of doesn't restrict us.
Okay. With that qualification, I'll remove my objection. And any other objections? Seeing none, amendment 4 is adopted. Representative Keller.
I would move, Mr. Chair, amendment number 5.
And I will object for discussion. Amendment number 5 is to line 4, or page 4, lines 18 and 19, and that would be after cost efficient on line 19, it would insert family-based. And Representative Wilson?
Was it the intent of Mr. Keller to have the word conceptual in his amendment? He didn't say that. And so was that your intent to say that?
Yeah, they're all conceptual because of renumbering and whatever.
So this is a conceptual
This amendment? Is a conceptual amendment. Mr. Jeans, question, are there some early learning guidelines that support effective, cost-efficient, and optional pre-elementary programs that wouldn't be family-based?
Mr. Chairman, the department has already developed the early learning guidelines that I believe would meet the requirements under this new statute, and there are components in there that are family based. But it's not limited to family based activities. So as long as we understand that this adding family based doesn't limit us to family based programs, then I'm fine with the language.
Yeah, and Representative Keller. Is the intent of this, or do you read this amendment as restricting the guidelines that support programs to family-based programs?
Mr. Chair, I do not.
You do not. Okay. Are there further questions? Representative Booth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do not see how this would not limit it. I mean, you are talking very specifically about placing these guidelines under these requirements. So my concern would be that you would be limiting the department's ability to determine the effectiveness of the guidelines and how they develop them if you state that you're going to use family-based as the requirement. So my concern is that we're being exclusive here, and that is my concern with the sponsor of the amendment. I would I don't have a problem with the concept that family should be involved where it's appropriate. However, there may be circumstances within the development of this program where it is outside of that purview. So my concern would be that we don't make it exclusionary in the development of this particular process.
Thank you, Representative Keller.
I'd like to ask Representative Book or Eddie Jeans if they could give me some explicit examples of situations where the family wouldn't be engaged even to the point of making sure or having the option to make sure the child's there. Whoever the custodian of the child is will be engaged. Otherwise, I do want to be restrictive. I want whoever is the custodian of the child to have some engagement. That's the intent of the plan, and I don't think it hurts it at all to include it in the guidelines here to say that it should be.
If I might.
Representative Book and then Gardner.
I would have to defer to the department. They're the experts here, and they have the expertise. So that is my concern.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I guess one way to phrase my question is, and it's similar to Representative Books, is if you have a four-year-old whose parent wants to send them to school but wants no involvement otherwise whatsoever with the program, would this language mean that that child couldn't attend?
Representative Keller.
Yeah, Representative Gardner, I don't think this language would, no.
Okay,
I think the jurisdiction of the parent, in a court of law, maybe, but I don't think this does that at all.
So, Mr. Chair, would it be adequate to be on the record that this is, number one, a conceptual amendment, and number two, not intended to exclude children whose parents want the child to participate but do not themselves want to participate in a program?
Absolutely.
Mr. Jeans.
Mr. Chairman, I'm reading this section of statute again, and we're talking about the early learning guidelines that support effective, cost-efficient, family-based, and optional preschool, pre-elementary programs. I mean, that seems like a pretty broad definition to me. So it doesn't just restrict it to family-based programs.
Reverend Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we read this in the context of the bill, on line four, it says duties. This is duties of the board. The board shall adopt, and then this is one of the things the board shall adopt. Early learning guidelines that support an effective, cost-efficient, family-based, and optional pre-elementary program. This is something the board has to do. I think that is something, when we see the word shall, that's something that we want to make sure gets done. So I think that it is a shall. It doesn't say the board may adopt. It says the board shall adopt. So I don't know if that means that you would have to change some of your guidelines already that or your regulations. I mean, I don't know. But I think we need to think about that.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Representative Book, and then Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. According to the description from the department, I will remove my objection to amendment number four.
Reverend Munoz.
Well, I don't want to belabor it too much, but family-based, by definition, are those programs that have a parental requirement or involvement, or is, I mean, I know we're splitting hairs here, and I don't want to delay it too much, but I think we've already had the clarification that this is broad enough that it doesn't restrict you, but I was just curious, does family-based imply a certain type of program?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, the term family-based does imply programs such as parents as teachers, but you're not going to find a specific listing of those programs that fall under a family-based program. And I believe that the early learning guidelines that are already adopted by the State Board of Education address all the components that are currently required in this section.
Representative Kawasaki, as sponsor, do you have comments on this?
No, I just appreciate the work from the member from Wasilla and his support and families. I think that it's necessary. I don't have a problem with the conceptual amendment, and I'll work with the member from Wasilla and the member from Dillingham to make sure that definition is rigid and somewhere in code.
Is there further comments? Representative Edgman.
In the quest to find clarity this morning, Mr. Jeans, on the last page of the bill, on line five, it says statewide goals and require each governing body to adopt written goals that are consistent with local needs. So consistent with local needs, add that phrase to our discussion on family base. Is there alignment between those two phrases, if you will, or terms, local needs and family based?
And that is referring to the current requirement that the state board shall adopt. Statewide goals and the new one, which is the early learning guidelines requirement. Mm-hmm. And the question was, is there any conflict or coordination between those separate duties of the board? Representative, or
Representative G.
Wow. Mr. G.
You keep trying. You do keep trying. Mr. Chairman, I think that's right in line with the direction that the department's headed. Programs that target individual students based on community need. And we want to keep that very broad so that we have the flexibility to develop different programs based on community and parent needs.
Okay, so, thank you. So, and Representative Edgeman, follow up?
Is that a very nice way of saying that you don't need family-based in line 18? Mr. Jeans. So.
Thank you.
I've got it on line 18. I think it's actually line 18 of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edgeman, I don't think the term family-based is going to restrict us or encourage us to go in any other direction than we're already going. I think we're headed in the direction we're going, whether that language is there or not.
Okay, so that's a nice way of saying it's okay then.
That was Representative Edgeman. Okay, further discussion on amendment number five, conceptual amendment number five?
No.
Seeing none, I'll remove my objection. Are there any further objections? Seeing none, amendment number five is adopted. are there further amendments? For clarification, the amendments number 3, 4, and 5 were conceptual amendments that were adopted. And there was clarifying language or discussion on each of those for the drafters to understand our concepts. They'll have fun. Representative Munoz.
Mr. Chair, will we have this bill before us again, or are you planning to move it today?
Unless someone has a real desire to bring this back, I would plan on moving this out. I think that the discussion, we've had adequate discussion that I don't think there'll be confusion. Unless members want to see the actual language as it's drafted.
Are you ready for
Yes.
Okay.
Wait a minute. Is there further discussion on the bill after these amendments? Seeing none, Representative Munoz.
Okay. Thank you. I'd like to move CS for House Bill 59, version 26-LS0329/E, as amended with individual recommendations from committee.
Very good. Do we have
an attached fiscal note? I'm sorry. Yes. I believe it was a zero fiscal note.
Mr. Representative Kawasaki, we have a zero fiscal note. Are there objections moving from committee? Seeing none, House Bill 59, as amended, will move from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Thank you.
Brief at ease. And we're going to take up Senate Bill 57, Charter School Funding, at this time. And we have Senator Thomas with us. And Senator Thomas, would you go ahead and introduce the bill for us? And we appreciate your attendance.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Senator Joe Thomas, District D, the Fairbanks area. thank you for scheduling this legislation so quickly. CS for SB 57 is about supporting school choice and doing away with the charter school penalty, as I refer to it. Current law results in charter schools with under 150 students receiving 30% to 45% less state funding than neighborhood schools of their same size. The colored chart in your packet graphically demonstrates the effect of the current law, SB 57's change, and the comparison to regular neighborhood schools. Excuse me. This legislation solves the funding problem in an equitable, fiscally responsible manner. CS for SB 57 states that charter schools with fewer than 150 students will have their count adjusted by the same per-student rate as neighborhood schools with 400 students. CS4S B 57 also addresses a problem created for school districts when their charter and alternative schools unexpectedly enroll fewer students than the number required for the state to fund them as separate schools. Today, the minimum number of students a charter school must have to be funded is 150, and the enrollment an alternative school must have is 200. When these schools fall just one student below those thresholds in the October count period, the state cuts funding by $500,000 to $700,000. This is a disaster for the school as well as the district. CS for SB 57 contains a one-year hold harmless provision for charter schools and alternative schools that unexpectedly fall below the threshold and are either in their first year of operation or were above the threshold the previous year. For 1 year, these schools will receive to 95% of the per student rate they would have received at the threshold. Charter schools in their hold harmless year must submit a budget to their local school boards laying out the plan for the following year if their enrollment does not rise. Finally, CSSB 57 lowers the separate school threshold for alternative schools from 200 to 175. Alaska has a serious problem with school achievement and high school graduation. One type of school is not best for all students. Charter schools and alternative schools offer parental choice within the public school system. This legislation has received strong support from around the state. We have been contacted by parents from Ketchikan to Nome, the Alaska Association of School Boards, and representatives of Fairbanks, Nome, Juneau, Anchorage, Lower Kuskokwim, Ketchikan, and Matsu school districts have testified in favor of CS for SB 57. Our school funding system has limited communities' ability to create and sustain innovative programs. It is essentially legislature take action this session, and I would appreciate your support.
Thank you. And are there questions for the sponsor? I think we have seen an overview on charter school funding. We were wanting to address that issue. We appreciate having a bill before us to do that. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question for the sponsor. And Senator, is there a minimum for charter schools? In other words, I know that to begin with, the reason that the charter schools were funded like regular schools down to a level of 150 students was because to protect the state from a bunch of low enrollment charter schools, and so just to keep them from popping up so that there would be so they would be getting a disproportionate amount of funding. So is there a minimum?
I think that it's the same minimum that exists with public schools in general, which is 10 students, I believe.
So we can
Representative
have
Representative Wilson.
Through the chair, I'm sorry.
I apologize. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And they could have 10 students, but they would get paid for 400. Or they would get paid for as the same amount of students that would be for if there was a school of 400.
Actually, if you look at the chart through the chair, Representative Wilson, if you view the chart, you will see just how it actually works for in blue neighborhood schools and red charter schools under the current law, and our change in orange, if you will. So you see what takes place. They are. That's how the count is adjusted, and it takes place at basically 150. But the funding, you're correct, is for a 400 school, a neighborhood school, which is considered a school of 400.
Per child, not the total.
Would you like
per child? That's correct.
Yeah.
So our follow-up, Representative.
Representative Wilson.
So where we're seeing this right across here, this is per child.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I'd just like to point out on the chart that we'd seen before without the estimate of SB 57 on here. The problem is the blue bars as you get smaller and smaller as a single-site school is showing that if it's a non-charter school, the per-child amount goes up and up and up because you don't have the economy of scale. And the purpose of this legislation is so that it doesn't drop so far that it's uneconomic to have a charter school under 150, but it doesn't give the same advantage as a small school would. So it just caps it at a level. There's actually a decreased amount because you're not funded at the higher rate for per student that you would get at 150 or above. It jumps up to the 400 student level. So that's not going to encourage an explosion, I don't think, of small charter schools, but the big problem has been that if a school drops below 150, the regular school district has to take out of its budget a large amount of money to offset because the formula then doesn't work to even hold the school district harmless. And we should, so I just wanted to explain how that worked. So. Senator Thomas, did you have further explanation on the bill?
Chairman Seaton, no, I appreciate your explanation. That's very, very good. And we, if you try and explain this, we had several charts that we developed. They're all very complex. This is the simplest one, the colored one, actually, that demonstrates exactly what takes place. And the one sheet example adjusted student count calculation kind of backs that up for your illusory.
And thank you. And members have that in their packet, and it's labeled, I believe, April 6, 2009. That's that calculation sheet and packet. Are there further questions for the sponsor, Representative Gardner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little bit confused about how this bill distinguishes between charter schools and alternative schools. And I mean, are they treated the same or not? And, you know, part of my thinking is that both of them offer alternative programs to the standard schools. My understanding is that the charter schools tend to have more engaged and involved families than the alternative schools, which sometimes are kind of not for, but serve the needs of kids who haven't been successful in other schools and they're trying something else. But in terms of funding and the fact that all of them tend to be smaller schools, I'm interested in arguments about why we might want to handle them differently than charter schools or the same.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Representative Gardner. They are, there's a couple of basic differences, the main one being that the school district still is in charge of, you know, how the alternative schools are run. There's more parental involvement in the operation of a charter school, so that's about the basic difference, how things operate. And I'm not sure if your question is regarding the 150 threshold versus the 175, is that?
I would just like you to tell me on the record if your bill proposes to make the same changes for charter schools and alternative schools.
It makes this, through the chair, Representative Gardner, it makes the same changes except for the threshold.
Okay. And Representative Gardner, just for clarification, that threshold means the size.
Right.
And for the listening audience, the size before the 95% would kick in would be 175 students on alternative schools and 150 on a charter school.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
Could there not be good arguments for treating the alternative schools in the same way as charter schools in terms of funding?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner. There certainly could be. The issue that we came to was more of a fiscal. Making the changes adds somewhat dramatically to the fiscal note. We were trying to keep the fiscal note down, realizing at least in our body that there is a real sensitivity to particularly this year, to those types of items, and figured that in the future we may very well approach a little more adjustment to things. But at least at this point, this was what was acceptable to move forward with.
Mr. Chair, I certainly...
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I wouldn't want to damage the possibility of your bill moving forward, but I'd hate to think that we're protecting the charter school students and not doing the same for the alternative school students who have the same needs.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, most of the comments we received were the concerns with the charter schools. The others were not particularly concerned with some aspects of it, and the testimony was that their main concern was reducing the count to 175. So,
and through the chair, just the final question, and could it not be that most of the comments come from the charter school community, because the point is that they tend to be more involved, and so the alternative school communities have the same needs but not the same involvement?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that may be, but we did contact folks to make sure that they had the opportunity to comment on the alternative schools, and the school districts did comment.
Thank you.
Representative Keller, and then Munoz.
Thank you. This is just a clarification for the record, and can be corrected if I'm wrong when the department comes up later, but an alternative school is not defined in any place in statute. It's defined in regulation as a school that's designed for the specific needs of particular kids. So any district can make an alternative school targeted at district kids. The thing that's interesting is that in that same regulation, a charter school is counted as a type. A charter school is a type of an alternative school. So the term alternative is kind of a broad term. And if you remember, I had a similar bill a week ago. And I found that the drafters were hesitant and had trouble because of our gray definitions of schools. You know, they didn't know really how to approach this. It can get kind of confusing. So thank you for that. Let me make that comment.
And Representative Munoz?
Well, thank you. Initially, I thought of proposing an amendment to allow the threshold to be the same for alternative schools and charter schools. But I don't want to delay the bill. I think it needs to move forward. It's very important. And I am willing to work with others over the interim on language that would include or lower the threshold for alternative schools. And also, there's another issue that has to do with federal funding available for charter school facilities. But we need state-compliant language in order to receive federal funding. And that's another issue that we can work on, too, during the interim. But I really want to see the bill move forward, and I support it. But if I can just make one other comment that on the facilities issue, charter schools have the responsibility of paying for their facilities out of their per-student allocation. And alternative schools are schools within the district. Charter schools within the district, but the facilities for an alternative school are provided by the district at no cost. Extra cost to that program, whereas the charter school has to pay for that facility generally out of their allocation.
Correct.
And you can speak to that, I think, if you want to make clarity.
Thank you.
Are there further questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, thank you very much, Senator Thomas. And if you or your staff are available to remain during our committee discussions, there might be some other questions.
I will remain until I'm forced to do otherwise. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So we have testimony from around the state. I'm going to ask people to try to limit their testimony. And if there's problems that you see in this bill, the committee substitute that we have before us, please identify those, and expedited testimony would help. We want to make sure that we can get through with this bill today, if possible. We've had this before us as far as a overviews before. So if not, we will go ahead. So I'll open public testimony. Let's see, Kiki Abramson, are you online?
Representative Seaton, this is Brad Faulkner. Kiki was here, but it's standard-based assessments today statewide, so she had to go to her classroom.
Okay, well, you're next on the list, Mr. Faulkner. Would you like to testify on House Bill 57?
Yes, I would, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Brad, can I ask you to hold? Can you stay on the line for a few minutes? We have a person in the audience that has to leave for some of those same kind of things. So could you hold about 2 or 3 minutes?
Yeah, I'll hold. I'll be here whenever.
Thank you very much. Is it Brenda Taylor?
No.
It is Laura Skelling. Would you come forward and identify yourself and who you represent for the record? And
you bet. Thank you so much for allowing me to speak. It's a busy week, as you can imagine, at our district, and our superintendent is away. I'm assistant superintendent of the Juneau School District. My name is Lori Scandling. Thanks for listening to me on this. I want to speak specifically to the alternative high school, alternative school consideration. I've spent 11 years as a manager of an alternative program within a high school and then a separate alternative high school here in Juneau. I'll make a couple quick points. One is the alternative high school students are funded at the rate of the largest school in the district, 0.84. That assumes that there are economies of scale at an alternative program that reflect the alternative, the economies of scale that you might achieve at a large high school. I can tell you that's simply not true. Related to that issue is the type of student who finds themselves in an alternative program, and it's usually because for whatever reason, there's a plethora of reasons, they haven't found traction or success in a mainstream program. And one of the differences between alternative and charters, you're going to find, I think, a concentration of secondary students in alternative programs and a concentration of elementary students in charter programs. It's not true across the board, but I think you'll find a greater correlation on that level. The reality is that students who end up in alternative programs, and I know this from longtime direct experience, are extremely intensive. They are in an alternative program for a reason. So the rationale that they're being funded at 0.84 at the same level that a large high school can achieve certain economies of scale simply does not hold true in your alternative programs. They bring with them a host of issues that require intensive support, both academically and socially. So I would ask you to consider dropping from 200 to 175 or 150 the level at which those students could be funded at, I think, a more equitable level. I certainly would prefer 150, only because of my own research into the effectiveness of organizations that operate at the tipping point of about 150. I understand the need for expediency here, and your consideration of whatever number is most appropriate most certainly is up to you. Those are the key points I want to make. There is a disconnect between that assumption of economy of scale and the true intensive needs brought to bear at alternative programs by the students who need our extra support.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. CS for Senate Bill number 57, are you in support?
I did not see a copy of it out on the table, so I can't say that I have read the entire thing. I have tried to follow most of the language as it's gone through the process this year in terms of equitable funding for charter schools and preventing that, well, the term now from the federal government is funding cliff, so I'll apply that. So I would be reluctant to say yes or no. I'd be happy to take the time to read the current CS and get back to you on that, but I would be premature if I were to say, particularly on representing my district, that I supported the entire bill as it stands today.
Through the chair, thank you for your commentary on the alternative schools, and we will definitely keep that in mind as we proceed.
I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Representative Keller.
I apologize.
No, thanks for taking time out of your schedule to come talk to us. The there's an alternative school in Juneau.
There is.
With a population of about 150, I think.
It runs on any given day between 130 to 150,
correct.
Yes.
And if we lower this threshold, for alternative schools down to 175. Do you anticipate an action to try to get 25 more students in that?
That's an excellent question, and thank you for your attention to the specifics in our district. I'm very proud of this school, by the way. As you might know, it's been recognized nationally on other levels as a model program, so I'll just say that while I have the opportunity. Let me tell you that when I was principal there for 4 years, I looked at the annual numbers of total students served, and it actually ran about 190. But because we do a quarterly admission system, there is a rollover of students each quarter. Of course, our challenge would be to ensure that a greater number of students were enrolled by the count date. So I think that, you know, 150 certainly is more manageable and better for students because you begin to lose effectiveness after about 150. But I think that school, I worked with it and its site council on a long-range plan of a 3 to 5 year implementation of up to 200 students, understanding the current level of 200 student level funding. We were concerned about size. Small makes a difference. It's why students end up in alternative programs. But the short answer is yes, probably. However, I would note, and I'm sure the committee completely understands this, the money does not flow to the school per se. It would flow to the district which hosts the school. So it becomes a general revenue source for that district, and it's up to each school board to determine, as well as with the staff, the allocation of that. And I will say that the Juneau School District has stepped up to the plate generally over time in supporting it with the type of resources that it needs to. That's a long answer, but the answer is yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you very much for taking questions and your testimony.
Appreciate your allowing me to step forward first.
Let's go back to Brad Faulkner. Are you there? And would you identify yourself on the record again and who you're representing?
Chairman Seaton, my name is Brad Faulkner. I'm in Homer, Alaska. I'm here to testify in favor of this bill. And I represent Fireweed Academy as a member of their academic policy committee. First, I want to say, because it is standard-based assessments today, most of the teachers that would be able to testify will not be available. Second, this bill is not perfect from a charter school point of view. We're a school of 90 children. We'll be funded like a school of 400 children. We'll still be sharing a facility and getting substantially less money than the other children in the facility. However, it's a good start, and everybody in the charter school community supports it. And we're very happy that you're doing the work that you're doing today. Because alternative schools and charter schools are mentioned in the bill, the same bill, I'd like to point out a couple of major differences. An alternative school gets local funding. A charter school does not get local funding. When I pay my property taxes on the Kenai Peninsula Borough, not a penny goes to fund that charter school. It's about 30% of their budget. So right now we start with 30% less than the other kids. And then we're funded approximately 26 to 30% less from the state level. And it's important for everybody to understand that charter schools do not get a local funding. But the other thing we don't get is any funding for a facility. So in the past, it's been up to 90% bonding for facilities of state reimbursement. I think currently it's around 60%. But out of that state funds, we also have to pay for our facilities funding. And I just want to say one thing that's kind of a misconception, that charter schools get all the good kids. In Homer, because of our reputation for doing so well with the children, we get a lot more of the needs-intensive children than probably is our share, and that is a real misconception that I heard voiced today. However, this is an imperfect bill from the point of charter schools, but the community of charter schools supports it very strongly, and it's a really good start, and we would hope that you would pass it out. And thank you very much for having this meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Faulkner. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you again for your testimony. Let's go to, let's see, I think we have Brenda Taylor. Oh, no, we have Jeff Friedman. Are you online, Jeff, in Anchorage?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. Would you go ahead and identify yourself and who you represent for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony?
Yes. Chair Seaton and members of the Education Committee, my name is Jeff Friedman, and I'm president of the Anchorage School Board. Our board has discussed charter school funding several times in the past, and although we don't have a specific formal position on this bill, I believe I can fairly state that the board and administration are fully supportive of SB 57. We have had, in the past, significant problems with the 150-student cutoff. At least since my time on the board, two Anchorage charter schools have closed because of that, or two have had problems. One closed, the other struggled. And prior to me being on the board, I believe at least one charter school has closed because of the 150-student cliff. The changes in SB 57 provide a safety net for schools that drop slightly below the 150-student level, and also provide a more equitable funding method for alternative schools and charter schools. Charter schools and other alternative schools provide important choice for those students who don't fit well into a traditional neighborhood schools. They have become a vital part of our district, and I urge your support for SB 57. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Are there questions? I don't see any, so thank you again for your testimony, Jeff. And let's go to Todd Hinman. Todd, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Welcome. Would you identify yourself and who you represent for the record, and go ahead with your testimony on SB 57?
Yes, my name is Todd Hinman, and I'm the lead teacher at Anvil City Science Academy here in Nome. And I'm speaking in support of SB 57 on behalf of Nome Public Schools Board of Education and the Academic Policy Committee of Anvil City Science Academy. In a small community such as Nome, a charter school with a student population of 150 is highly unlikely. And if it were able to be achieved, that it would most likely have an adverse effect on the other public schools. The small size of ACSA is one of its strengths. It allows for flexibility in its daily operation to provide unique educational opportunities to its students. This allows students to easily get out in their community and the environment to use it as a resource in their education, providing a more meaningful learning experience. Our small school also creates a culture around family values to ensure student success through daily engagement with our parents. I'd like to thank you for your efforts at providing support for small charter schools, which are identifying and meeting specific needs in the communities they serve. Thanks.
Thank you, Todd. Are there questions? Seeing none, well, thank you, and the committee does appreciate the choice that you offer the diverse students in communities. Nancy Wagner?
Yes.
Nancy, would you identify yourself and who you represent for the record, and go ahead with your testimony?
Yes, I'm Nancy Wagner. I'm the superintendent for the Fairbanks North Shawboro School District. And I would like to thank you, Chairman Seaton, and members of the House Education Committee for sharing our testimony in support of the Senate Bill 57. I would like to express that we do extremely support the charter school bill. These charter schools provide choice and alternative educational programs for our students. We currently have three charter schools, and we have a new one that's coming online this coming school year. And two of our current charter schools are, and our new one, have target enrollments around 155 students. So, you know, struggling to meet that 150 threshold is not uncommon. But one of our charter schools has missed that target two times, actually, in the 4 years that it's been in existence, but just barely missed it. And so this provision in this law would be of great benefit for us. The charter school missed the target by, you know, just they did have 150 students, but it was just following the count period and falling short of the enrollment thresholds, which ended up costing our district $680,000. And that's not a small thing. It's really, you know, a burden on the district to have to make up for that shortfall. We expect that our existing charter schools will be larger than 150 this coming year. That school in particular is doing an early registration and a very intense campaign recruitment of students. So we believe they will meet the 150 threshold this coming year, but that's there's a very thin margin there. And so, you know, we think that with this bill, it is a fair compromise for funding for our charter schools. We also expect it would be difficult to offer the curriculum that we have and that we envision if we, you know, can't feel sure that we're going to be funded. And if, you know, falling one or two students short costs the district $680,000 in 1 year, that's not something that we can sustain over time. And just barely missing the enrollment is, you know, is not huge. It's not like we only have 100 students involved. It's really close to the 150, or it's meeting the 150 after the count period. So this bill fixes the funding problem in an equitable and fiscally responsible manner, and I would encourage you to pass the bill. Education is important for public school systems, and we are charged with the responsibility of meeting the needs of every child enrolled in our district. Alternative programs and charter schools provide the opportunity for Alaska families to choose the program that best fits their child's needs. And without the provisions outlined in the Senate Bill 57, at least one of our charter schools could be in danger of having to close. So I thank you for listening and for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 57.
Thank you, Nancy. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thanks again for your testimony. And we'll go to John Wetman?
Yes, Wheatman.
Wheatman, thanks. Would you identify yourself and who you represent for the record, and go ahead with your testimony?
Yes, good morning. My name is John Wheatman, and I am the Assistant Superintendent of the Matsu Borough School District. I wanted to thank you for this opportunity to testify in favor of Senate Bill 57. The Matsu Borough School District supports Senate Bill 57 and is supportive of school choice and currently hosts 4 charter schools and 3 alternative schools, which enroll approximately 1,500 students. I do believe that Senate Bill 57 will correct the funding problem in an impartial and fiscally dependable manner. By lowering the threshold for alternative schools from 200 to 175, Senate Bill 57 will address a financial setback that occurred this year for the Matsu Borough School District. One of our alternative schools unexpectedly dropped below the required 200 number by only 6 students, resulting in a $780,000 deficit to the school district. The 1-year hold harmless provision for the charter schools and alternative schools that unexpectedly fall below this threshold allows charter schools and alternative schools to focus on student education and not the financial deficit created by the current funding system. Charter schools and alternative schools offer parent choice with public school systems and provide smaller learning communities, dropout prevention, and increased graduation rates. In conclusion, Senate Bill 57 creates a sustainable funding system for innovative programs. Thank you for your time and effort and all that you put forth for our students of Alaska.
Thank you, John. And for you and everyone else that has been giving testimony, if you have written testimony, it would be helpful if you could email that in to me or fax it to me so we can include it as a hard copy in the record. Thank you. Let's see. Are there any questions for Mr. Wheaton? Seeing none. Melissa Hill, thank you again. Melissa Hill, are you online? Is there anyone else online that wishes to testify on House Bill 50, or on Senate Bill 57? We had one other person. Brenda Taylor, in the audience? Come forward, Brenda. Welcome. Would you identify yourself on the record? Go ahead.
Hi. My name is Brenda Taylor, and I'm the president of the Academic Policy Committee, which is the governing board for the Juneau Community Charter School a few blocks down the road, and I'm a parent of 2 children there. Thank you very much for hearing this bill and for expediting it as much as possible. We had a charter school conference a couple of weeks ago, and charter school representatives came from across the district, and I was very impressed and amazed at the range of different kinds of charter schools. There are project-based ones, there are back-to-basic ones. They range the whole educational philosophy. It's not a particular kind of a charter school. The one thing that we could agree upon was that the importance of choice, and that when parents have choice, and when teachers have choice, and when students have choice, there's a passion that comes along with that that makes people become more involved in their schools, whether it's the teachers or their parents. So it's not just that involved parents choose these schools, but that when parents get to choose the kind of education, whether they're even involved in thinking about that, it makes them become more involved in their education. In the same way we were talking about preschool children and parents understanding what's going on with their young children's education. I think that's a lot of the idea behind charter schools, is parents and teachers working together on the vision. I think it's that choice, that passion, that makes charter schools be able to survive because they are facing difficult odds. I think there's charter schools, as has been pointed out a little bit, have more expenses than their neighborhood schools. They have to pay for the lease, for space. For us, we lease space for a private landlord or landlord down the road, we have to pay for our janitorial, we have to pay for parking, we have to pay for those sorts of things. As much as we can, we reduce those costs by using that passion of our committed teachers and parents and students. So we do quite a bit of the custodial care. We provide supervision for the students during playground, during classroom time, during office staff. We do as much as we can that we would have to be paying for if we were in a neighborhood school by volunteer labor. And parents and teachers are willing to do that because they care so strongly about it, because they've become committed to that small environment that Lori Scanling was talking about. We do have to pay the same costs in terms of teacher salaries and in terms of office staff that are hired through the district. We have to pay all the PERS, all the TERS, all the same steps and levels. So we have those same costs the district has. One of the things that we have to do as a result is make difficult choices, and I think some of the parents have alluded to that in the kinds of things that we can't offer to our parents. For instance, we've chosen not to offer a counselor because we do not have any funds for that, and we feel that that makes our school perhaps less accessible to students who would really benefit from having a counselor. And so with these funds that would bring us not up to the neighborhood school rate but increase our funds somewhat, we would pay for more of these services to make our school more accessible to more different kinds of parents. We'd be able to pay for an Indian paraeducator that would help our school be more culturally relevant to the people in Juneau. But up until this point, the small charter schools have had to make difficult choices. Other schools have decided not to hire a music specialist at all or a PE specialist, but to have their classroom teachers take that over. However, teachers, again, and parents are willing to do that because it's their choices that they're making. They would just like to have a little more financial resource to make it. Those choices not be so painfully difficult. And finally, I would like to really urge you to work on this as expeditiously as you can, because it is a question of survival for some of these small schools, and our school in particular is running at a deficit of $20,000 to $30,000 a year, and we can't survive. And we'd very much like to use all the energy that we've worked on in legislative work to be going out and helping more parents work with us to do all those sorts of things that a school would really like to be able to do. And finally, I want to say that we very much support choice in terms of optional programs as well. And I understand you have a difficult decision in front of you in terms of how deeply to look at the alternative schools matter right now. The one thing is that alternative schools do have the district, because it's the district who's directly supervising and running the alternative schools, the district has more flexibility in how the funds are used. And so they can take from their big pile of money, as Lori Scanling was referring to, and decide where to appropriate it. Whereas the charter schools have their funds that come directly from the state, and there's no flexibility for them. They don't have outside sources of funds in the way that alternative schools do. But I really do hope, I think that we've made an important step by adding this amendment with 175, and I hope you really look at the alternative school issue when it's possible. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Keller.
I just want to say thank you for your work and your engagement.
My daughter's little. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. This isn't the first time we've found your testimony to be very compelling, so we appreciate that. One of the things I'm struck by is the reference to possibly using funding to get a bus.
mm-hmm. and then more children would be able to attend the school who currently cannot because of transportation problems. And I wonder, you know, how much that would apply to charter schools across the state that run into problems because of lowered count.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly, I think, as students get a little bit older, then mm-hmm. there are fewer parents who are able to do that. Do you think that providing transportation would be a big factor in helping charter schools maintain their counts or even grow?
I think so. I think it's different school districts run things differently. So I know, for instance, in Ketchikan, that their bus system works, that they actually can get busing from all the different neighborhoods to the different schools, and so they actually have choice within their transportation system. That's our district is more spread out, and it doesn't work that way. However, in Juneau, there's the model for the high schools of any students in Juneau being able to choose to go to either of those two high schools. So I think the district is looking at choice, and I think this bill really helps districts think about how can we look at choice. So the district's beginning to think about how can we offer more choice at the elementary and the middle school areas as well. I don't know what the big answer to it is. I don't think it's simple, and I don't know if that helps a little bit.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Thank you again for your testimony.
Thanks very
Appreciate
much.
It. Let's see. Is there anyone else in the audience to testify? And we didn't have anybody online. That's all. Close the public testimony on Senate Bill 57. And we have the bill before us. Are there amendments to Senate Bill 57? Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Are we going to hear from the Department of Education?
We sure can. Eddie, would you like to? Good morning again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Director of School Finance for the Alaska Department of Education. And
Mr. Jeans,
I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have on this bill or the fiscal note.
Would you explain the functioning of the 95% per student?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Basically, there's two hold harmlesses in this piece of legislation. The first one addresses the charter schools that fall below, that had more than 150 students in 1 year and then find themselves below 150 in the subsequent year. Basically, what that hold harmless says is we're going to fund you at 95% of what 150 students would generate. So it's a transition. It allows them to plan for the upcoming year, whether or not they will have 150 students. This particular piece of legislation requires them to develop a plan and submit it to their local school board. As far as the alternative schools, it also has a hold harmless provision of when a school has more than 175 1 year, falls below 175 the second year, and there again, it funds the school as if it had 95% of 175 students. In the subsequent year. That's the short description of what that hold harmless does. So what it does is it allows them to plan for that transition to reduce funding or figure out a plan to recruit more children so that they can meet the threshold of 175 or 150 for charter schools.
And does the department feel that this is an equitable way for long-range planning to occur in these
Mr. schools? Chairman, I think it's an appropriate response to the, as we've heard described, the cliff funding. So I think it's a very appropriate response, and it allows districts at 1 year to plan for the upcoming year.
Okay, thank you. Representative Keller.
I just would like you to clarify, make sure I'm thinking about this right, but when you made your fiscal note, you didn't do any second guessing on what the alternatives are going to do in the future, alternative schools are going to do in the future. As I read the fiscal note, I see MATSU as a big winner in this, and I'm delighted. I want to declare my conflict on that, and I will be supporting the bill. But we had two, as I read it, we have two alternative schools that are near the 200 threshold and one that has dropped below the 200 threshold. and the potential impact on Mat-Su School District is high, and I think that ought to be on the record, you know, that that is the case. And I think it's appropriate. I think an alternative school does better at 175 than it does to larger, you know, that school size, like the assistant superintendent here from Juneau pointed out, is a good number. And I'm supportive of the bill. But am I thinking about this correctly? That's my question.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, you are thinking correctly. In fact, if you look at page 3 of 3 on the fiscal note, you'll see that Mid Valley Alternative High School had 193 students this year. They're projecting 174 next year, so that actually puts them one child below the 175. So they would qualify for the Hold Harmless funding in fiscal year 10, I guess it is. Or they could have over 175 students and they'll be funded as a separate site. But it's based on the projections that the school districts provided the department for fiscal year 10.
Okay, Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, this is a question to Rep. Keller. I think of one of the schools out in the valley. What is the other alternative, or what are the two alternative schools out there?
Through the chair, Representative Book, on page 3 of the fiscal note, it lists them there. Valley Pathways Alternative School is at 204 for fiscal year 210. Birchall Alternative High is at 211 for fiscal year 210. Very good schools. I'll vouch for them.
Further input.
Representative Book.
Where's Mid Valley located at?
Representative Keller.
Middle of the valley. Thank you. This is just an aside. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have addressed the students at Birchall in the past regarding certain opportunities and missed one. Anyway, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there further questions for the department on SB 57 or on the fiscal? Okay, seeing none. Thank you, Eddie.
Yep.
Are there amendments for SB 57? Does any member wish to hold this bill for a second hearing? We, like I said, a little unusual moving on the same time, but we've discussed this issue. We've had overviews on this issue. We've looked at it in detail, and I think that so essentially, even though we haven't had two hearings on this bill, we've had more than one discussion on this topic and looking at these details and many of these graphs. And so I would be willing to move this if that's the committee's, unless the committee wants to hold the bill for a second hearing. Representative Keller?
I'm willing to make the, motion to move it, but I want to put on the record, and just for the committee too, that I feel a sense of loss in the sense that we're against sending money that is not tied to incentives for academic excellence. I'm pro charter school, you know that. You know, I like choice. I love the way the system is working in that arena. I would rather have put this money forward with a caveat to incentive for excellence, because I believe that that excellence that I would propose is already being met by most of the alternative and charter schools, and I just would like to see that tie in our funding mechanisms as we put them forward. So, just so you know what to expect out of me in the future.
Thank you.
I have to thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have to state on the record that when we started out, I was not too excited about charter schools, and mainly because I felt that if teachers were going to get excited, that they should get excited in the main school, you know, and if parents were going to get excited and do all this volunteering and everything, they should do it at the regular school. And I think maybe I've probably changed my mind a little bit realize that we do have students that do need and another choice sometimes in families. I'm kind of excited if I could make the motion.
That's fine. Is there any member that wants to hold this for a second hearing? on this particular bill. Like I said, we've looked at the issue. Seeing no request for that, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the CS for Senate Bill number 57, version S, with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Seeing no objections, CS for Senate Bill 57 will move from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. And thank you to the sponsor for coming over and joining us. We now,
Mr. Chair, just make a comment about that bill?
Representative Gardner.
I have in my packet are all of the surveys and things about why students drop out. And if we go through these, we can find many of the reasons that are given are addressed by charter schools. And so in response to Representative Keller's comments, I agree. And we talk about, you know, parental involvement being a critical factor. Bam, the charter schools have it. Classes interesting, real opportunities for learning, and we won't go on and on, but I just suggest that members may want to just review those and see how charter schools support our efforts to improve the graduation rates. Thank you.
Good. As we're signing those, let's thank you again. We now have before us House Bill 215, Student Counts and Teacher Salaries. And Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to introduce House Bill 215, and the reason that I have put this bill together is because we do have a need to give schools additional tools to provide the best education possible for the students. And repealing the salary scale limitations for out-of-state teachers will make it easier to recruit teachers for hard to fill positions. And this bill also will make sure schools are doing what's best for kids. And I want to combat high dropout rates, and I think averaging school counts between the fall and spring will help. I know this may cause some grumbling from some of the school districts, and I understand where they're coming from, but this is the right thing to do for kids, and we have to make their long-term education needs our first priority. And I'd like to have Daniel DiStefano from my staff to come forward to present the bill.
Okay, thank you. And this is the first time we are hearing this and these issues, so it's not the intention to move this today. Welcome. Would you identify yourself on the record and go ahead with the introduction?
For the record, my name is Daniel DiStefano, staff to Representative Wilson. Thank you, Chair Seaton, for the opportunity to present this bill to the committee for consideration. HB 215 will repeal salary scale limitations for hiring new out-of-state teachers. Additionally, it will average student counts in the spring and fall to determine school funding numbers for the following school year. We believe this will help address multiple problems facing Alaska's education system. Specialty positions such as therapists and special needs teachers are in high demand in school districts across the country, and Alaska is facing a shortage. By allowing school districts to negotiate salaries on a case-by-case basis for out-of-state hires, Alaska schools will be more competitive when vying for needed educational professionals. Left over from territorial days, the statute limiting years of out-of-state experience that can be applied to a new hire salary scale has become an obstacle that is hurting our schools. A bigger issue we are hoping to combat with HB 215 is the extremely high dropout rates across the state. Testimony on other bills the Education Committee has heard this year describes how unmotivated or problem students can be pushed out rather than encouraged to stay in school. By averaging the student counts that are used to determine school funding, we hope to create a financial incentive for school districts to keep students in the classroom past the annual fall count. Current statutes provide for one student count to be held in October of each year. Funding for the same year is dependent on that count. HB 215 will establish counts in October and in February. These counts will be averaged and then used to determine funding for the following year. There will be an additional count in October of the current year that will be averaged with the previous February's count. In the event that this average is higher, funding will then be increased for the current year. We hope that providing this added financial motivation, school districts will work towards higher student retention rates. Dropout rates are a big problem that this bill won't solve on its own, but we believe it needs to be attacked from multiple angles. This bill has the additional benefit of determining a solid funding level for the upcoming school year, and this gives school districts the ability to work with concrete numbers when they plan their budget. To better serve Alaska's youth, we need to proactively address the issues of high dropout rates and teacher recruitment, and HB 215 does that. I'd like to thank the committee for taking the time to hear this bill. I will be available to answer questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for the sponsor? I had one, and that is on page 2 where we're talking this, the fourth Friday in October and the last Friday in February. Does the last Friday in February correspond with any particular times when students are historically gone from any holidays or any time frames? Does that correspond with any school breaks where students are leaving with families on vacations or anything like that? Has the sponsor looked at that designation to see if there's any correlations to exit time for students for any reasons?
Chair Seaton, I have not looked. We might want to ask Representative Wilson if she's aware, and if not, I'd be happy to find out.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We really picked that date because by March 15th, we have to know whether we can give the pink slips to teachers, and so we wanted that count to be before then because that would be schools would be able to know for the next year what their counts possibly would be.
Okay, and what I would just like to, and we don't need an answer now, but I just want to make sure that since we've got this in a statutory framework, that we look at the different school districts across the state and make sure that that date that we're specifying does not correspond with, you know, AFN conventions or with some other holiday or some time where we have a difference between, and it may or may not, I have no knowledge that it does. I just want to make sure that we look to a, that we make sure that we're not picking a date that could have some unintended ramifications, and that's all I'm asking for. And so I don't need an answer now, but go ahead, Daniel.
Chair Seaton, I believe that's the end date, not the specific date that it has to be conducted on. So that's when it has to be finished by. So, and there'll be adequate time for students to be in class before that end date.
Okay, and that's good. I just want to make sure that we're considering all those functions. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Regarding the salary scale for
and are you looking at a particular part, or are you looking at the sponsor statement?
The sponsor statement in the second paragraph, and you made the comment that the current statutes were left over from territorial days. Is that actually true?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes, I believe it's true. And Eddie Jeans from the department has the exact timeline on when school funding was taken over by the state.
Oh, thank you.
Are there further questions for the sponsor? Representative Benjamin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in reading through this bill, it almost seems like it could be two different bills. And you got two subjects that I guess are interrelated, but just a question to the bill sponsor. You got two sort of separate components mixed into one bill, one on student count for school funding purposes, and the second repealing school experience for salary scale provisions, but you combine them for a particular reason, I guess. I'd like to hear that.
Representative Wilson.
The only reason they were combined was just so that I didn't have to have two separate bills. It was just easier to put them in two or in one bill than to go through the whole nine yards of doing two bills.
And Representative Wilson, when this bill was drafted, you didn't get anything from Legal saying that it was any problem with a single subject under our Constitution.
As long as it covers, if you realize that it's funding purposes and salary scale provisions, so those two qualify to sure. fit.
Representative Edmund.
We don't have a fiscal note, I take it, given that this is the first hearing of the bill?
Yes, this is the first hearing of the bill. Are there further questions for the sponsor? Let's ask the department to come forward. I guess, and before the department, we have a chart. Was this passed out by the sponsor, or was this? While we still have the sponsor's representative up there, we have a chart before us. Would you just quickly go through that chart so that everybody understands how that's working? It says funding for the 2011 school year with a 335 BSA.
Right, it's for the 2011 school year, and I had omitted the 2012 school year as well. This was just a little graph to conceptualize the student counts. They're in October 10, February 10. When you average those two numbers, you come up with 335. So school districts are going to set their budget based on that 335. Then the following counts in February in 2011 and October 2011, you have an average number there. If that average number had been higher, we would have increased the funding. But instead, because the 335 is higher, that number remains the funding number for the upcoming fiscal years. Did I answer your question, Chair Seaton?
Sure. I think so. So it's October 2010 and the February 2011, so we're within the school year. And then we're looking at February and the October from the following school year. And so is that the estimate for the following, or is that the actual?
That would be the actual number. And because funding is distributed over the next, or each month, then the increased funding could be given each month based on that higher average count.
Okay, well, good thing the finance director is here so he can explain, walk me through it. Eddie, would you care to? Can you go through this formula really quick and?
I'd be happy to, Mr.
Explain
Chairman.
To me how we've got the multiple years. And
sure. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the director of school finance for the Alaska Department of Education. Mr. Chairman, probably the easiest way to do this is if you look at the October 10 and February 2011, we're looking at fiscal year, school year 2011, right there. And so there, the average of the two counts was 335. They would be building their 2012 budget based on that number, knowing that that's the guaranteed level of funding that they would get. When we move into the 2012 school year, we would use the February count from 2011 again and do a new count in October. If the student count increases over that prior count, then the district would get the benefit of the higher count in the new October count. If not, they get the amount that was calculated in the prior year, which in this case is the 335. So it's a good planning tool. It allows them to know their minimum funding level basically 6 months in advance. They start the school year July 1. They know at a minimum they're going to be funded on 335.
And is that because of the hold harmless on declining enrollment?
No, it's based on this new provision that would require two counts, and you average those two counts. So so we, moving forward, we would do another count in February 2011. That information, February 2012. We would average the February 2012 and the October 2011. That would set the minimum that the district's going to get for 2013.
12.
Okay, so it'd be the coming here. Okay, that was where my confusion was coming. Representative Gardner, and
Thank
then,
you.
Did you have? No.
I have two questions, and I think for Eddie Jeans, would this new count system also impact funding for intensive needs students? And then the other question I have is sort of broadly the impact on rural schools. And we've talked about people coming into the urban hubs or to the cities maybe in the wintertime and going back out in the spring. And if those students re-enroll, assuming they do when they get back to the rural areas, that would, I would think, kind of help funding for rural districts and maybe adversely impact the hub cities and the cities.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, currently we have the one count. It's in October. Typically, that's the highest peak of the student enrollment in the school districts across the state. By doing an average, I would anticipate that there's going to be fewer students funded through the foundation program due to us doing an average. The reason we picked February was you have to get a couple months out beyond Christmas, but you can't get out too far because we have to have time to analyze the data and recalculate everybody's state aid. So would you pick up those students moving back out in the springtime? I'm not sure if it would quite cover that, but clearly we're doing an average between the two counts to give you a better sense of what the overall school year population looks like as opposed to picking the peak to provide funding for.
Thank you. And the intensive needs? Is that
Representative Gardner.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that would include intensive needs counting as well. It would be an entire student count again in February.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Jeans, am I understanding this right then that we would actually be directing the funds to where more reasonably to where the students are actually in attendance throughout the year?
Through the chair, I think that would be the case. We've heard discussion over the course of this legislative session about children leaving, say, correspondence programs after the count, going back to their district school. The district school would get the benefit of counting those kids in February. Students that leave Mount Edgecombe or other boarding schools in the state, the districts would get the benefit of picking those students up again. And in response to Representative Gardner's question about the intensive needs students, we've looked at the movement of intensive needs students from year to year. We have almost 1,900 intensive needs students in this state. We have about 25 to 30 students that move after the count. Those families tend not to move because once they have their children in their educational program, they don't want to disrupt that setting.
And it is 10 o'clock, and so we're going to have to put this bill aside. Folks are concerned. Make sure they express their concerns. We'll bring this bill up again, and we'll have that public testimony at that time. And thank you very much, and it'll be 10:02, and we're adjourned.